You're listening to episode 88 of the Play Therapy Community Podcast.
Welcome to Play Therapy Community Podcast, providing connection, information, and inspiration to child therapists all around the world. Here's your host, a licensed psychotherapist, a registered play therapist, and my mom, Jackie Flynn.
This episode is brought to you by our first annual Playful EMDR Summit. Join us in Cocoa Beach, Florida on November 3rd through November 5th, 2022. So if you're listening to this after those dates, then that just means that our first one has happened and we're going to have more after that. So if you want to come to the pre-conference, that is on November 2nd. So the speakers are Marshall Lyles. He's going to be talking about the art of transition, supporting play therapy clients through all of the EMDR phases using expressive arts, and Ana Gomez. She's going to be presenting on EMDR processing and microprocessing in the sand tray and play therapy with attachment injuries in children. Oh my goodness, those are two of the best. That's so exciting that they're coming here to Cocoa Beach. And Beckley Forrest and I are going to be doing some of the play therapy community presentations. There's going to be some EMDR-approved consultants there for live consultation. This is Annie Monaco's dream. She had this dream of having an EMDR summit for clinicians that work with children. And this dream is coming true and it's going to be amazing. Okay, so if you hear some sounds in the background, I'm recording this on the 4th of July and the neighbors are sending off their fireworks. So those sounds are some celebrations, just in case you're wondering what that was. All right, so I get up early in the morning. So if you do attend the Playful EMDR Summit, I would love to walk with you on the beach there with our feet in the water. I'd love to tell you all about how I do the intensive EMDR sessions with my clients right there on the beach and talk about anything and everything that you're interested in related to EMDR, working with kids, or just a chat. All right, you can find out more or you can register for the summit at PlayfulEMDR.com. That's Ann and Annie's website. They have a tab that says Playful EMDR Summit. Just click on that. It'll take you right to the registration page. All right. I hope to see you there. All right. Let's listen to our episode. Well, hi, Dr. Welsh. Thank you so much for being on the Play Therapy Community Podcast. You know, I think the world of you. I first met you in an EMDR with kids training, eight phases of EMDR mm-hmm. with children and adolescents. And since then, we've done some work together and we've become really good friends. So I've really enjoyed you. And I've learned about your parenting model, which is fantastic, which we're going to talk about in this podcast episode. But before we do that, let me have you just introduce yourself. Tell people who you are and what you do.
Okay. First of all, it's weird having you call me Dr. Welsh because, okay. Yes, that's who I am. I'm Becky. But I am a faculty. I am full-time faculty at Colorado Christian, and I teach in the Masters of Counseling program there. So I love working with counseling students, right, and helping them get excited about play therapy, kind of in specific. But I also have a nonprofit private practice here in McKinney, Texas, which is north of Dallas, and it's called 360 Counseling Center. And we have a lot of student interns and LPCs and social workers and all that here working with kids and teens. And now we're kind of even doing working with the parents to help them get past their past so that they can parent better.
Oh, I love it. There's so many things I love about you, but it was clear right away that your focus on the parents is one of the many reasons why you're successful at what you do. And just, you know, one other thing was the way that you design your space is incredible. Then you gave me some pictures that I could share my trainings to show people how to design their spaces intentionally. But this model, it's so incredibly like practical and usable, but comprehensive in nature. So let's just start off right there and just kind of summarize it. And let's get some dialogue going about how to work with parents in the play therapy setting.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's where this came from so long ago, that there's not a lot out there about really helping play therapists or even just child counselors work with parents. Yeah. Some even teach them not to. And so, you know, this was something that has just kind of evolved. I actually came up with this model when I was in an adolescent psych hospital. I was probably only 2 years into my therapy job.
Wow.
And and it was my turn to do the group therapy time with the families and the patients. And I was like, what am I going to do? And I thought, what do these parents need to hear? And then I thought, like, you know, what do these kids need that these parents need to hear? And of course, I thought of the word need and, you know, thought of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And I literally in like 15 minutes came up with these six needs of levels that kids have that I think parents, like, we know, yeah, but to actually, like, really think about how important they are and the effects that they have when they're not met, that there's a disconnect, right? And so just trying to help parents see, hey, there is this, you know, need that these kids have, and we can help you meet that need.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of how it started.
So six levels.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. So we start, and it's based on, like, just remembering that we're created for connection. And so this is called the needs connection model. And so it's about meeting these needs so that we have connection with each other. And in this specific instance, parent-child, right? So that first level are the basic needs. And it's not really what we would think of as basic needs, but food, sleep, mm-hmm, and then environment.
Okay.
And, like, for the sake of time, food and sleep, I think so many of us know, even from a scientific point of view, and not just from a physical developmental way, but cognitively and emotionally, the effect of food, good food, and good sleep have on kids in particular, right? But kids in particular, because of their developing brain, because of their developing body, and all that kind of stuff. So that is part of it, but I'll kind of, for time's sake, leave that there. But the piece I really like to touch on in this basic level is environment. And it's really about the way I present it to parents and then to other therapists who work with parents is, you know, when your child walks in the door, do they have that feeling of, ah, I'm home, it's safe? You know, I just saw your whole body just go like that. You know,
it's almost like you're speaking polyvagal theory, like in
totally
all of that, the environment and then the sigh, like, when I'm home, I feel safe. I feel connected.
That's right. That's right. And you know, to be able to feel that. Or do they walk in and it's chaotic? And it's unpredictable. And it's, you know, what are they going to be like today? You know, is he even going to be there today? Are they going to yell? Or are they going to be nice? Am I going to get bullied by my sibling? You know, there's so many ways for the environment to be chaotic and unpredictable. And, you know, we know what that does, that, you know, constant high stress level, what it can do. And so that's why I have it as the basic need. It has to be there before anything else can happen.
So if the environment is chaotic or unsafe, and there's not that connection, the unpredictability and their nourishment isn't there, if they haven't had sleep, then it like throws everything else off.
Yeah. And it, you know, some of that stuff can happen, But the way I've done my model, I would say it's quality plus progression equals a strong connection. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the better quality we have of the needs plus the progression of one need on top of the other,
yeah,
that's going to build the strongest connection. And if you see my website or podcast or anything, we have an image of a rope with a knot in it. And the reason we do that is to kind of help visualize each need being like a thread in a rope, and the stronger, you know, the more needs we can meet with our kids, with our friends, with our, you know, whoever else, supervisees, clients, that the stronger that connection is going to be.
We also know
that when it's not met, and, you know, as working with kids, we know so much of how those needs are not met in childhood, that the cool thing is it can be reconnected, right? We can reconnect that. So that's what this is about.
Oh, I love it. And I think about how many times we're working with parents and they don't realize that those things aren't in place. They may have grown up in a certain way, or just have like life designed in a way that isn't conducive to those things. So making them like tweaks and changes just in that one area can
totally
make a difference. Sometimes
motivation
is so huge.
Absolutely. And you're right. I have so many parents that I teach this to that, you know, just go, I didn't even think of that. Yeah. And we start working on just one thing at a time to try to change, to make it a little more safe.
Yeah.
Something like that, you know? So
I think about your personality too, Becky, the way that you speak about it and the way that you speak to parents, you kind of make it safe to be them too. You make it really, I just love your personality. That's one of the reasons why we're friends. Is you just have this safe relational aspect to you. So I can imagine how that comes out with in the parent-therapist relationship, to be able to communicate it in a way that doesn't leave them feeling shamed or wrong, just a way that they can just make these changes and feel the positive effects of it.
Absolutely. Well, that's what we want, because shaming them or judging them or telling them, you know, how wrong they're being as a parent isn't going to help.
Yeah.
You know, that's not going to help them. It's not going to help the child. And so if we can connect with them, and, you know, and that's why I say this works for therapists too. So if I make my environment safe, if I make it calm and soothing, then that's going to inspire them. Let me meet their needs as I can in this space, so they can go meet their kids' needs.
Oh, I love it. And you have a new office space there.
I do.
It's polyvagal design, to where you have all the safety connection pieces in there. Yeah. All right. I can talk your ear off just about that one, but I don't want to keep you. Like, what's number two?
So number two is trust. And obviously this is the part of attachment, right? And just being that secure base. The word that I stick with this one is consistency. You know, is the caregiver consistently giving that child what they need? Or are they, you know, sometimes I get this, sometimes I don't, you know, I mean, it's kind of pure attachment at this point, you know, kind of, are they getting that secure attachment?
Yeah.
Can they trust that their caregiver is going to give them what they need?
Oh.
No matter what age.
And I know that can show up in just really kind of indiscreet ways. Like, can I trust that there's going to be food in the refrigerator? Can I trust that mom says she's going to pick me up from school? Is it really going to be her? Is it going to be aunt? So that can.
Exactly. Exactly. And it can be so many things that we don't think about. Not just, you know, putting food on the table, but even a nighttime routine, or, you know, the predictability and the consistency of, you know, emotionally being there all the time, not sometimes being there and sometimes not.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, So that's the next level, obviously. And again, can be so applicable to therapists and clients, right? We have to have that trust. Once we've created that safe environment, then we can really start building that trust and going, you can count on me, you know? Yeah. So, and I will ask these kids that, who can you count on?
Oh,
you know, who's there for you? To help meet your needs. So I literally have a list of questions that on each of these levels that I can ask the kids, I can ask the parents, and help figure it out. Yeah. Oh,
I love it. And you have some, I know you were telling me you have some additional like resources, like practical that clinicians can actually use in practice with this.
Absolutely. Oh, so yep.
What a question too. Who can you count on? I'm thinking that immediately kind of gives you, not only gives you information, but helps the kid kind of realize, you know, who their support system is. And if it's not the person that is, you know, the parent or the main caregiver, then you can adjust your treatment or your consultation to
exactly
help improve that. Wow.
Exactly. And that kind of leads to the third level is a kind of a two-part question of who comforts you. Mm. Like when you're upset, who comforts you? And not only that, but a more important question of how do they comfort you? Because we were actually talking about this today in my staff meeting of a lot of people feel like they know what nurture is, and that's the third level is nurture.
Okay.
But a lot of people really don't. I had one kiddo and I asked him that. I was like, who comforts you when you get upset, whatever, who comforts you? And he was like, oh, my mom and my dad, and they're divorced. And I said, oh, okay. So how do they comfort you? And, you know, he said, well, he puts me in my room and, you know, just tells me to calm down.
Oh,
and you're like
the experience of comfort.
Yeah, and there wasn't no nurturing, right? It was go cool off yourself or whatever.
So expectation of self-regulation before the co-regulation was in place.
Exactly.
Nervous system, we need to be co-regulated before we can meet that piece. But that was what the child knew and they didn't know any different.
That's right. So the nurturing piece is still part of that attachment, right? But it's more not consistency, but meeting that comfort, that, I don't know, that below level kind of thing of, I'm not just going to meet your need and, you know, give you some medicine when you're sick, but I'm going to sit by your bed and I'm going to stroke your hair because you don't feel good. And, you know, and stuff like that. So it's really about like that love, care, protect piece of what nurturing is about. And that seems to be where a lot of people, adults included, have lacked. That's where they lacked. And so trying to give that to their children is next to impossible because they don't know how to do it.
Yeah. So it gets to be like a systemic thing. I think about Deb Wesselman's, I can't remember the exact title of the book, but even the title was like how to be a good parent when you didn't have one yourself or something of that nature. So the thought of they don't really know how to nurture because they haven't experienced it. Oh, doesn't Dr. Perry talk about that too in a way? Like,
and Dr. Siegel, I mean, Dan Siegel too. They do talk about that and, you know, kind of getting past your past, right? I mean, he has a whole book on it of, you know, you have to be able to work through your stuff so that you can parent better no matter what happened. Yeah. And so that's what we try to do here too, is, you know, offer that nurturing, not only to the child in the playroom in all kinds of ways, but offer it to the parent and like teach them and share with them some ways. Do you think you could do this? Do you think you could try this? So
love it.
All kinds of things.
You can actually kind of repattern family systems like that. Even like your intonation of voice, it just made me feel all warm and connected. But I think parents, It's hard being a parent.
Yes, it is.
It can be so challenging. But I think we fall back, unless we know differently, we fall back on how we were parented. So I know many times parents come to us and they have this tough love mentality, or, you know, they need to fear you and all of these things that aren't helpful and can't exactly. be hurtful. So, but teaching them in a way that they feel safe enough to actually take it in and use it, you can really change generations to come.
That's the hope. that's what we want, because that's exactly right. Yeah. So after nurture, which that was a really quick synopsis of, but
so your actual program has like way more like in depth.
Oh, each one. Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Of each one. And some experiential stuff to go with it. So but then the next one is it's time, but I could almost replace it now with play. Ooh. And the importance of spending time individually and as a family together, and playing. Yeah. And, you know, filial therapy, how many parents don't know how to play with their kids? Or when they do, it's, you know, they tell them what to do and they tell them the rules and the, you know, and I'm like, no, just try for 10 minutes. To sit down and let them play whatever they want, however they want to. So not only individually, but play is so important for the family, right? Having together time with the family, whoever that is, because that's where they learn social relationships. Yeah. You know, that's their first, you know, reaction to society and how to relate. You know, are they going to learn that when you get mad, you stomp off, or when you get mad, you hit, or give the silent treatment or whatever. And they learn all these things. And so having that time, it also gives them that sense of belonging, right? I belong. I have a place, you know, that cares about me and values me. And how many of our kiddos, how many of our kiddos have said, I'm not important. I don't matter. All those kind of things. And so this is where that kind of plays in. And so, you know, just helping parents find ways to play. And again, a lot of them don't know how. I've had literally one of my parents say, teach me how to play. I don't know how.
Oh, wow. And,
yeah. And so just being able to do that too can make a huge difference. And obviously the kids love it. You know, how many of our kids hear, you know, mom and dad don't listen to me, right? And so I tell them, if you will go into their world mm-hmm. and not try to make them come into yours mm-hmm. and just let them play, it's like you're sitting there just going, tell me what's going on. Yeah. And they're going to feel felt and they're going to feel heard. And so, you know, when they do, it's amazing. They'll come back and go, my gosh, that worked, you know? So that's time. Only two left.
Becky, that makes me think of like Dr. Schaefer and Dr. Drew's therapeutic powers of play, where it may look like to the naked eye that you're just playing, maybe even just kind of wasting time. But in reality, there's all kinds of stuff happening in the nervous system. They're able to even kind of work together and then, you know, be in that sympathetic state, in the ventral state, connected and
totally,
and stretch out their window of tolerance and communication skills. So valuable. Mm-hmm. Incredible.
And you know what I say in this stage? I always tell them, okay, so there's no electronics and all of the senses.
Mm.
You know,
put the phones away.
Yeah. Don't use any of the electronics, but use all of your senses and, you know, just play.
Oh, so, I love it. I love it. Yeah. So do you, as part of this model, do you just talk to them about that, or do they, do you facilitate it in your office, or is it like a little bit of whatever they need?
a little bit of whatever they need. So I typically present the whole model to the parents. Sometimes they watch the videos, like during, while I'm in the play therapy sessions, they will be watching the videos of it. And then I always have my parent feedback time. And so they ask questions. I have them come with notes and, you know, well, how is it going to work for this particular child? And how, and they recognize pretty quickly which level their kid is on. And I go, then that's where we start. That's where the healing starts right there. We're going to start at that point of disconnect.
Yeah.
And we're going to go back and we're going to meet that need and go from there. I had a six-year-old boy in the playroom the other day with both his mom and dad. They've been in there at different times. And he goes, gets the real baby bottle, fills it up with water, mm-hmm. and sits on their lap, and they rock him and feed him because he was traumatized for most of his early childhood.
Wow.
And so he is going back,
through time
to get that stuff, to get that need met now. And it's a beautiful thing to watch. I just cry when I sit there and watch it every time.
Oh, girl, I feel myself starting to tear up. So that's something that he didn't experience in like the developmental stage that many of us think that would be like infant, toddler.
Correct.
And here he is 6 years old. But you have the in your environment, you have what that takes to make happen, and it happened, and that connection was able to occur. Wow.
Yeah. And now with both mom and dad. So I just, I love that so much.
Oh,
yeah.
Just logistically with the real baby mm-hmm. bottle, do you have like a bunch of them, or how mm-hmm. does that work?
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, if they use one, then, you know, I'll go throw it in the sink so that nobody else can use it and have plenty. And I have real pacifiers as well. Because I have kids all the time sucking pacifiers as they're doing their play.
Oh, I love that. I love that. So, yeah, and I know that's kind of like when you get stuff like that, you can be pretty economical with them. I know like some of the lower cost department stores or like a Dollar Tree or something like that. You can, doesn't even have to cost an arm and a leg.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I got like six of these cheap baby bottles for, yeah, I mean, almost nothing.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh my gosh. So the full experience.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So kind of moving on, because I want to make sure we get it. There's so much to say. I wish we had like forever.
I know, even as you're like, even that, like I'm at a loss for words. I feel like crying with that.
Fine. Oh my gosh. I'm telling you, I did.
So beautiful. Oh. Mm-hmm. Oh, like it truly, and this stuff goes where words doesn't go, and just even hearing your voice, I can hear like the you witness nurture happen. That I know it's not even just like a feel good type thing. There's changes in the brain. There's like
totally, and I will tell you too, Jackie, because I remember I'm watching him, and his body was so relaxed. I mean, his dad was holding him, and I mean, there was nothing.
Oh.
Nothing tense on him. I mean, he was just laying there sucking the bottle.
So safety and connection right there. Oh, so powerful.
Absolutely. Powerful. Yep. To get reconnection, right? Connection to get reconnected, you know, in the brain. Exactly.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
So the next two are more... like if you look at the model, the bottom two are really brainstem stuff, right? They're like in the brain work, their brainstem stuff, just a little, you know, kind of thing. Am I safe? You know, is my environment okay, right? Mm-hmm. Can I trust?
Yeah.
The next two of nurture and time are mm-hmm. more about like the midbrain, right? The emotions, the attachment, all that kind of stuff. Then the last two are the higher functioning. They're the more cognitive upstairs brain, prefrontal stuff. So these are empowerment, and then discipline.
Okay.
And so empowerment is really the question we ask is, who believes in you? Ooh. Or if you're asking an adult, who believed in you?
Mm-hmm.
And then how did you know? How did you know they believed in you? What did they say? What did they do? You know, kind of thing. And so empowerment is really that almost rubber meets the road, because I really believe that a lot of kids can get those other needs met. But if they are one of two extremes, one kind of put in that bubble, yeah, where they're never able to take risks or to challenge themselves and kind of get out of that window of tolerance, mm-hmm, you know, to stretch themselves a little bit, then, you know, they become almost entitled, right? And help me, I can't do it. Mm-hmm. And they get that message. I can't do it because mom or dad or whoever do it for me.
Oh,
you know, kind of thing. Right.
And, where it starts. And it's,
yeah. And then the other part is the kind of the other extreme, where, you know, we do hear those parents this, you know, tell their kids, you're not worth anything and you're not going to be worth anything. And that, so the disempowerment of both sides of that, and just teaching parents that these kids need to go jump off, you know, a little rock or something. And if they hurt themselves, it's okay. You know, they need to climb on monkey bars. They need to run and risk and take challenges. And we need to be the ones that go, it's okay. Go give it a try. You can do this. And then to be there if they fall and when they fall, right? And to go, it's okay. Yeah. We've got this. Let's try again.
So allow them to make mistakes, allow them to engage in risky play, not be so rigid to where they don't have this opportunity to see their resilience or their capacity to do hard things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, all the research shows so much about how that has declined in kids in the last couple of decades. Yeah. Of just, you know, oh, we don't want them to get hurt. And, you know, one of the things I read even last night was so many parents are scared that they're going to get abducted. So they don't let them ride their bikes out in the streets anymore.
Oh.
And they need that. Yeah. And so at least finding a place where they can and that kind of stuff. So
that is, I can imagine, a concern. I'm probably in some areas more so than others, but
absolutely.
Thinking about riding your bike, like I ride my bike every day. There's bilateral, there's this beautiful equilibrium that you get from being out in nature and the wind, and you just feel alive. And if
absolutely,
they're sedentary, like in their house, even if they're moving around in their house, it's mm-hmm, still very indoors, and it's still very kind of closed in, so limiting in the movement. So
totally.
Outdoors play, there's a lot of riskiness with outdoors play too, that I think that can, like climbing a tree. Mm-hmm. I remember at the beginning of COVID, you know how like we were doing the Zoom and like the kid started climbing the tree, and I looked on the screen, I was like, oh, we're up in a tree right now. And I'm thinking, oh gosh. It was risky play. I texted Mom. I was like, is this okay? She's like, yeah. Yeah, she climbs a tree all the time. I was like, okay.
Good. Yeah, that's awesome. But we've almost been conditioned to go, don't let them get hurt. You know, and that's not good.
Yeah.
That's not the way we need it to be.
I'm not safe, or I can't trust my judgment, or mm-hmm, I can't get myself out of different difficult situations.
Wonderful. Absolutely. Okay. Well said. Yes. So highest level, and you can see how that's part of the cognitive, right?
Yeah.
And so if they're down in trust, and we're trying to work on this cognitive stuff, we're trying to empower them, but they don't even trust us.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
So you got to start from the bottom and go up. I'm thinking that's kind of the way the brain develops too, or it's not kind of.
Exactly.
Or it's at the brain stem. And
as much as we know how the brain does that. Yeah. So last level then is discipline. And of course, this is, you know, in my parenting workshops where all the parents are like, okay, this is what I've been waiting for. Discipline, you know, how do I discipline my kid? And I sorely disappoint them every time, because discipline isn't about punishment, you know? And in my belief, behaviors are there as a response to an unmet need.
Ooh.
It's not there to manipulate. It's not there just to get your attention. It's not there because they're bad, or even necessarily that they made a bad choice.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's, or a lot of times it's a reaction and a response to an unmet need, whether that's a trigger or trust or nurture or environment or whatever. So
that's so important, Becky, because I think about, and before I knew that, there is like this kind of leaning towards taking it personally, like the child's doing something, they must be doing it on purpose, or they're trying to, and just that unmet need and adaptation of their situation. When you look at it through that lens, then you can adjust the situation and the behavior goes away. It keeps that beautiful relationship in place, but also their sense of self is not lost in the process.
Totally, totally. That's it. And so the thing I also share too for connection is, so many parents think that, gosh, if I just, you know, give my kid food, clothing, and shelter, those basic needs, and if I discipline them and help, you know, make them obey me, then I've done my job as a parent. And, you know, those are the bottom and the top, right, of my model. And all of that stuff in between, the trust, the nurturing, the time and play, and the empowerment, they miss that. And I say, look at what you're missing if that's all you're focused on.
Yeah.
You're missing the whole connection piece of what makes relationships work. Right? Is that trust and safety and nurturing and time and all that. So, you know, I start there and just say, you got to have it all. Because when you've got the relationship and when you've got the connection, they want to obey you. They want to please you. But if you're doing it for fear, it's not going to work. You know, it's not the same.
I know when we have our defense mechanisms up, we don't even function as well. And it's an entirely different vibe going on. I think the child, everybody shows up in that space differently, and we're not at our best selves. So, and it does too, like the brain develops differently, right? Like as far as
absolutely,
like the capacity to have other relationships with themselves and others is changed.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so, you know, it's like, you know, just thinking about, it's not about punishment, you know, it's not about, you know, and even for me, that discipline is almost like, where's the respect I deserve as a parent, right?
You know,
I want that. And, you know, they're not respecting me because they're not obeying. And, you know, for myself included, going, what am I doing to earn that respect?
Yeah.
What am I not doing? Yeah, to earn that instead of just demanding it. And so discipline is more about the visual that I give as a path. And, you know, like whatever the goals the family has, whatever, you know, their values are, I set those out there for them. And go there. That's at the end of this path. And our job in discipline is to try to keep them on that path towards those, our family goals, whatever they are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can do that through teaching and training and rebuking and correcting, which is, you know, teaching is teaching them new things, right? We have to teach them new things. Training is the skills. Like, you know, it's the drill before the match when I play tennis. You know, that's what training is. It's learning those skills to do the thing well. Mm-hmm. And then rebuking is the thing that the non-negotiables, that there are those times that you have to say, that's not okay.
Yeah.
Cannot do that, right? You get back on the path. And then the correcting is more of the, here are your choices. If I were you, and if I'm looking down that path and that's where you want to be, this is what I would do. But it's your choice. And you're able to try to correct them and go, think you're a little bit off. But sometimes as parents, we have to kind of let them go into the weeds a little bit before they come back. And it's not fun. I've been there.
Yeah.
And, you know, but yeah. But it's important, right? That's part of discipline.
Yeah.
So that's in kind of in a nutshell what the model is.
Oh, I love it. That last piece kind of makes me think of like the metaphor of they have to get in the driver's seat to learn how to drive. And sometimes it's, you know, it's a learning process. So to be able to have those experiences and make mistakes, but also be supported along the way.
But exactly.
Room to do their own thing too is cool. Wow. So you developed this 2 years into your clinical work?
I mean, the overall model, yes. Has it evolved over the last 30 years? Yes, it has. But, you know, what's been fun is as the neuroscience has, you know, been more prevalent and stuff, to see how it fits perfectly in with that has been really fun. And then just in the last 2 years, moving it from just teaching it to parents to training other therapists so that they can work with parents in the same way in their practice.
Oh, so super cool. So, so from using it firsthand, which is, that's magnificent in itself in your practice, working with the parents of the kids that you work with, but thinking about when you train other therapists, other clinicians, it's like the concentric circles. Like it just goes on and on. They're going on to help the families that they work with is right. Just exponentializes. Wow.
Right. Well, I am totally in the Ericksonian stage of stagnation versus generativity. So I am like trying to get my generativity and like, you know, counsel other counselors so that they can keep doing the work.
Oh my gosh. That's like one of the things I love about you. You're just such a giver, but I think of like your vision of being able to kind of grow in a way that changes the world. And it is interesting how like you developed this like a couple of years into your clinical work, but all of it fits right in the lens of neuroscience and like that safety and connection. I love the polyvagal theory. It's like, like it really, every piece of it, it really does. Fits right in there. That's beautiful. Yep. I love it.
Thank you.
Now, can you just briefly go over the six stages? You call them phases, right? Six phases, just with the...
I call them different things, but yes. You would think after all this time, I would like have something that I would call it, but I really don't. The basic needs are food, sleep, and environment, right? So that's the foundation. Mm-hmm. And then trust goes on top of that, the consistency, you know, who can I count on? And then the nurturing, which is who comforts me and, you know, how do they do that? Time, who plays with me and that kind of thing. And then empowerment, who believes in me? And then discipline, who leads me, who guides me?
Oh, that's so good. And it just crawls itself right up from the brainstem up to the prefrontal cortex. That's so good. Now, I know there's way more than we talked about here. It's like a whole thing and can like change lives and can't possibly cover it in like half an hour that we have for this. Where can people go to learn more from you if they wanted to get the training or get services from you or whatever you have to offer?
Yeah, right now, go to 316counselingcenter.org, 316counselingcenter.org. But I've also set up that's going to be launching drbecky.com, because that's what all the kids call me. And so that's where all the courses and the therapist training will be held. But right now, the parenting course and stuff is at 316counselingcenter.org.
Okay.
So, and Facebook and Instagram and all that.
Okay. Facebook, Instagram, the social media, I'll put all the links below this video. So wherever you're watching it, but if you're just listening to it, then just kind of type those in yourself, or you could put in Dr. Becky Welsh, probably bring you somewhere close to it at least. And oh my goodness, I'm so excited. And we talked about it. I may even be able to get to teach it once I learn it enough to be able to do it justice.
I sure hope you will.
Oh my gosh, it's so exciting. Oh, Becky, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. And thanks for putting this beautiful work out into the world.
Well, thank you for having me. I love being with you always.
All right, catch you later. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.